Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell. And in the studio with me this week is Russ Chianelli. And we have a guest from the University of California at Merced from the Department of Physics. His name is David Struber. And his particular little game in science is to do theoretical calculations to model structures and properties of condensed phases. And you might say, what is that all about? Well, that's why he's here on the program, to tell us what that's all about. But it's got some very interesting applications all the way from, nuclear fusion, you know, that wonderful source of energy that's out there on the horizon. It's a very long horizon. And also things like, you'll listen, you'll find out. David, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, before we get into condensed matter and your modeling prowess and things of that nature, let's learn a little bit about David. How did you get into becoming a scientist?
My father did a PhD in physics. There was always a lot of discussion about science and math going on in our house. But I hadn't thought originally of doing physics. In high school, I was actually very interested in rocks and minerals. We used to go out on hikes and look at the rocks that we saw around and collect them. I became interested in learning about what is stuff made of, and so I decided to study chemistry in college to learn more about that. But as I was taking some required physics classes for the chemistry major, I started realizing I really was very interested in that, and actually not so interested in some of the chemistry classes I was taking. So I decided to do a double major in chemistry and physics.
Where was the study?
And that was at the University of Chicago.
Okay, yep. So it's quite a nice school.
And where did you search for the minerals, and what did you find?
There are a lot of old iron mines from the 18th century in the Hudson Valley in New York, where I grew up. And so you can go to these mines, and they're fairly small ones. You can actually bring a magnet from home, and you can stick it to the wall of the mine, and this is the stuff they left behind, but it still is magnetic enough that the magnet will just stick there.
And did your parents go out with you on these expeditions, or?
My dad did. My mom is not a hiker, but my dad is very enthusiastic about it.
So anyway, then it was pretty well ordained in what you're saying, that, you know, with all this science and physics in the family, that you grew up with this, and so it didn't seem alien. It just seemed like a natural sequence of events.
Yes, that's right. My sister is an astronomer, too.
Oh, right. So then from Chicago, you had to go, obviously, did you do research as an undergraduate student? Something you got into?
I did, yes. I spent a summer in our research experience for undergraduates program there. And in fact, one of the other participants is in that program named Jorge Munoz. He's my host here for the physics seminar. He's a professor of physics now.
Oh, at the University of Texas at El Paso.
That's right. Yep.
That's how you make connections, and then those connections grow.
Yeah.
And then after Chicago?
Then I went on to grad school in physics at Berkeley.
So you went to Berkeley for graduate school studying physics. What did you study? What did you choose a thesis, or did it sort of get chosen for you by the person you wanted to work with?
I guess somewhere in between, I kind of stumbled into several interesting topics. So doing theory, it's easy to study many different problems and many different materials. So there was not necessarily one easily overarching idea.
The theory was all preordained. You went there to do modeling of some description on some materials, science materials, right? Decision.
Yeah, that was one thing that I was interested in. I was considering doing experiments also, but I ended up really liking the research that I saw being done in the group of my advisors, Steve and Louis.
Experiments, they're messy. They're not always reproducible, for one thing, because of various subtle variations. And, that's bad enough right there, whereas calculations, if you've done it right, come around each time, right?
That's true, although if your code isn't good enough, sometimes the calculation isn't reproducible either. You have to be careful about that.
So what did you choose to study? What was putting your prowess as a coder and as a physicist? What topics did you want to investigate?
So I studied organic materials for my thesis. So I did some development of an improvement of methods to study the materials and some applications that were about nonlinear optics So we can double the frequency of light with a material, and looking at molecular electronics, where we are envisioning possible tiny electronic devices that just considers a single molecule with electricity flowing.
So tell the audience a little about this nonlinear optics, where you come in at one wavelength and you do magic and it comes out at higher energy. Tell us a little bit about how that works, because that's an expression that the population will have learned about.
Then include quantum entanglement.
It didn't the way we were doing it, but it could. I think the best demonstration of that, actually, the green laser pointer. It's hard to make a green laser. These are more expensive than the red laser pointers, and they actually don't contain a green laser. What you have is actually an infrared laser whose frequency is being doubled by a crystal of lithium niobate, usually, or lithium dihydrogen phosphate, something like that, to double it. And basically, with some materials, just the way you get the electrons sloshing around when light comes in, you can end up sending out light of double the frequency.
Is it still a hot area?
It is, yeah. It's been becoming particularly interesting for things related to quantum computing and trying to make a kind of computer chip that uses light rather than electricity. So with nonlinear optics, you can have two light beams interact with one another, so one can control whether another goes through.
Okay.
But you were saying there was no quantum entanglement, which I know has been a subject on this program with the frequency doubling for a long time. Could you explain that and tell us what quantum entanglement is?
Sure. Well, so quantum entanglement is meaning basically that there's correlation between the states of two quantum systems. Yeah, it could be two electrons or two other things. I guess you can use nonlinear optics to help you create quantum entanglement in some system. At least the way that we were thinking about it, just studying what materials property you need to get nonlinear optics, you don't necessarily have to think about that property, but you can set up a circuit with nonlinear optics where you're entangling photons, and then you can do some interesting kind of quantum information experiments with that.
So you were mentioning just now the whole idea it could be useful for sort of quantum computing. And then that gets on to what people are talking about now, quantum dots, and then layers of quantum dots. And I know you're working in that area. So what comes first, quantum computing or quantum dots, in terms of explaining to the audience where these fit together?
Let's talk about quantum dots.
Okay, yep. So let's talk about quantum dots. So what is a quantum dot? Tell us.
So quantum dots are tiny particles that are sizes between a few and 100 nanometers, maybe so smaller than the width of a human hair. They can be made out of different materials, metals or semiconductors. So this was the subject of my undergraduate research project, actually, was lead sulfide and cadmium selenide quantum dots. And we were looking at them as a material for solar cells. They can absorb light well if you make them carefully into a film with some organic molecules in there. Then electricity can flow between the quantum dots, and so you can actually get a current as you would want from a solar cell in this thin film.
And what's the question that a theoretician like yourself is trying to model? The purity of the material, or how they mix together, give you new structural arrangements? What is it you're trying to determine then?
Well, that was actually an experimental project for my undergraduate summer experience. And the question is how can we make them efficiently, and how can we form them into a film so that electricity can actually flow? But yeah, one of the special properties of quantum dots is that the light, the frequency of light that they absorb and therefore their color depends on how big they are. And so there's a particular size you want so that it will capture a lot of light from the sun. And if they're too big or too small, then you won't get the right.
What about two-dimensional materials?
Right. So that's one of the projects that I'm working on now, which is a two-dimensional molybdenum sulfide material, which is a material that just is stacks of thin layers. And there we're looking at this material actually as a lubricant. So it's kind of like graphite, just as you can You use a pencil, and it you can rub off the layers nicely onto a piece of paper. Molybdenum sulfide can work the same way, and this is a material that NASA is interested in, actually, as a lubricant you could use in space where liquid things like oils and greases don't work.
What about graphite? What's wrong with graphite?
Graphene
is pretty cheap, and why is molybdenum sulfide to be preferred, perhaps?
Yeah, so graphite is good on Earth, but in vacuum it doesn't work as well. So that's of course a situation that you can have in space.
Tell us about that. Why? What's gravity got to do with graphite being a good lubricant?
Well, it's not about gravity. It's about air and oxygen specifically. To be honest, the ultimate answer to that question is one of the things that we hope to learn in this research. It's not entirely clear what the oxygen is doing in the graphite and the MOS2. And so we hope to learn where exactly it's going and how that's impacting the friction properties.
Well, when you're talking about MOS2, are you exfoliating MOS2 or are you making it chemically?
We have a couple of different samples that we're looking at, or more precisely that my experimental colleagues are looking at that have been made by different approaches. You can take the bulk material and you can break it up into flakes by an exfoliation process. You can also synthesize it by just mixing together different gases in chemical vapor deposition.
Yeah, so it's a two-dimensional material, and exfoliation just means pulling it apart like you could do with graphite to graphene.
Yeah, like taking a stack of paper and...
So that's the whole principle of using this material as a lubricant. But it's got some special properties that I gather that make it useful in space.
Yes, that's right. So that it can operate in a vacuum and at low temperature. These are really the special things. But it's not quite good enough as it is. JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, was looking into how could they improve the properties, and they were thinking of adding different metals into it as a dopant to see how that could work. And so that's where we come in. We're studying putting nickel into the material and trying to figure out how that will impact the properties and hopefully improve them.
Where the nickel would simply replace molybdenum in certain sites of the material. Not just doping molybdenum sulfide with a whole bunch of
Well,
nickel.
I mean, when you talk about that, you're talking about a catalyst where the nickel actually intercalates rather than gets in the MOS2. Which is it?
It depends, actually, the conditions under which we make it. So it could be that the nickel is substituting for the molybdenum or maybe even the sulfur site in molybdenum sulfide. But another common possibility is that it just goes between the layers, since it's a layered material, and so you have nickel just in there between the layers.
You're listening to the Science Studio. We're having a conversation with David Strube from the University of California in Merced, California, and he's right up the alley of young Russell Chianelli here, who's getting quite excited for the first time in weeks. And so we'll be back after a short message. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, David Strube from the University of California in Merced. And we're talking about molybdenum sulfide as a lubricant. And I've found out that graphite doesn't work very well because of a lack of oxygen or something like that. All sorts of entertaining things. But David doesn't do experiments anymore. He did as an undergraduate. Now it's all sort of pen and paper and computer. How do you approach learning properties of this material when you don't actually know what the material structure is? You're not quite sure where the nickel is, right? So how do you go about trying to sort of understand properties when you don't know this basic structure?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that's actually the reason why we want to do some theoretical calculations here is to answer that question. Basically, we can consider different possibilities, different sites where the nickel might be, and we can calculate what the energy is for each of them and see which is the lowest and therefore the most favorable. But it's complicated, the different ways that they make the material. It's possible that what you get in synthesizing it is not actually the lowest energy one. So all we can actually offer from theory is probabilities of which ones seem plausible that they have in there.
But when you're doing calculations like that, don't you work with experimentalists, for example, on a synchrotron where you can figure out where the nickel is?
Yes, I mean, that certainly is the goal. We want to characterize the samples we have. So we're actually calculating vibrational spectroscopy, like with IR or Raman spectroscopy, where you're using light to probe how the atoms vibrate, and that can actually tell us the difference between the different sites.
I mean, and just thinking from the simplest point of view, if you're using something as a lubricant, it's going to be under a certain stress. It's going to be under a certain pressure. And that's capable, perhaps, of transforming one structural type to another. I mean, so that's something else you have to think about. And can you actually do calculations to impact the structure of something with pressure?
Yes, absolutely. So that is something that we'll look into as the project continues. There are several possible structures of MOS2, and we could certainly transform between them. Yes, we can impose whatever pressure we want. In theory, it's very easy. It might be difficult in experiment, but in theory it's simple. And actually, one of the key things that we want to learn about in this project too is about what the engineers call wear, which is basically damage to the material over time. So it's very important for space. For your car, if you have if the lubrication fails in the wheels, you get an oil change. Simple, but if we send up Mars rovers, they're up there. They have to last for as long as they can, and nobody's going to come and do any maintenance.
Do you happen to know what lubricants they use on the things that are up there trundling around on Mars or the Moon?
I believe they are using some MOS2 already. Another option that I think has also been used is that you can have oils or greases, but try to seal the environment, and you could try to keep it warm so that it is at the temperature where it will function properly.
Now, before the program began, we also talked a little bit about your interest in materials that can be sustaining very, very high temperatures. And this, I think, is something that I'd like you to chat about for a minute. What's the interest in these materials that can withstand such high temperatures?
And what do you mean by a high temperature?
Right. So this is an area that we call high energy density science, where we're studying materials under extreme temperature and pressure. Actually, the materials can't necessarily withstand it. This is often a thing you study as they are blown apart by incredibly powerful lasers. But the interest in the subject is this is what things are like at the center of stars such as the sun, actually the center of large planets like Jupiter as well.
And at the Earth, I mean, we have wells that are coming flowing out of all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, that's not extreme enough temperature for
the Earth is not extreme enough.
No. So we're thinking of temperatures where you can actually get nuclear fusion. To happen. And so we're working with people at Lawrence Livermore National Lab, where they do these experiments with incredibly powerful lasers to heat up materials and try to get fusion to happen. So this is partly a way of studying what happens in nuclear explosions, but also a project to try to figure out how you could do fusion energy on a...
And fusion, again, for the people out there that aren't totally sure, you just bring two hydrogen molecules together, two hydrogen atoms, and produce helium. I mean, that's in the essence what we're trying to do, correct?
Yes, that's right.
And I know you say Lawrence Livermore. I know up the road in Sandia. A lot of people are doing experiments as this is the sort of holy grail, if you like, of energy production. But you need to be able to do this in a vesicle or a container that can withstand such high energies being produced. And tell us, do you get involved with some of the people doing this work? And what sort of temperatures have they been able to get up to? And how much energy does it take to actually produce any energy?
Yeah, well, it takes an incredible amount of energy. The way that they quantify progress about this is trying to get to to break even. So you put a certain amount of energy in with the lasers, and then you get some energy out from fusion. If you want this to be a way of producing energy, then you have to get out more energy than you put in. So far, they're not at that point, although they're actually getting reasonably close. But it's been a project going on for decades, and probably will be for decades to come, of figuring out how really to do this in a way that would be practical as an energy production method.
When you say close, what do you mean?
I think that they're within a tenth of the energy you get out is around a tenth of the energy that you put in. I think that's around what the state of the art is.
That's an order of magnitude to go then.
That's right. But they used to be many orders of magnitude below that. So there's
quite a significant progress being
made.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So where do you come in? What are you trying to do in this area?
Part of the difficulty of trying to get fusion to happen here is that when you blast this material with lasers, you have to get that it's all concentrated in a small area in order to actually attain high temperatures. That has to last long enough before the material is blown apart. So the properties of the material as it's heated up to these extreme temperatures and pressures are very important. I mean, being able to control the shape and how the heat actually flows within it. So that's the part that we're trying to simulate and understand, which will help to design and interpret the experiments that they're doing.
So if I was to think about this from an experimental point of view, but on your calculation, if you have a structural material that you've got in your little mind, okay, and you now provide it more and more and more energy, which is essentially saying raising temperature, must always come to the point where there's so much energy that the whole thing just blows apart. And so what happens when you do calculations like that? It's just that, what happens? It just never coalesces, never gives you an answer, and then you've gone too far?
We can actually just do a calculation in which we just decide what the density of the material is going to be and just fix it like that. I mean, that's the beauty of the of doing theory in this area. It's extremely hard to do the experiments. We're working at temperatures that are at least 10,000 degrees Celsius and could be up to 100,000 million like that. But we can just set the temperature to whatever we want in the calculation and do that, even if it might be very difficult to see how to attain those conditions experimentally.
And so what is the temperature that is considered to be appropriate at the moment for reality in the materials that can withstand the sort of energy we're talking about?
Well, so in order to do fusion, you need to be on the order of a million degrees. I've been here for a meeting this week with our partners on this project and the funding agency, and they were the people from Lawrence Livermore were talking about low temperatures being 10,000 degrees or so. So you know that's sort of where we start, and we go up from there.
I understand the nuclear fusion part, but you also talked about solar cells.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do you know what a Gretzel cell is?
I do. Yes, that's actually what we were.
You just passed the test.
Good. Yeah.
Well done.
You get an A.
Yeah. That's actually what the goal was for my undergraduate research project, was to make a Gretzel cell where the light absorption.
Okay, but half the audience, 90% of the audience, don't know what a Gretzel cell sounds like. Something out of a fairy story, Hansel and Gretzel or something. Yes. So what are we talking about?
Right. So a Gretzel cell is a kind of solar cell that has liquid in it. I guess that would be the simplest way of putting it. So when light is absorbed, there's actually some molecules in solution that are carrying the charges around to another electrode, and that's what makes the current flow after light is absorbed. I mean, it was invented by Professor Michael Gretzel in Switzerland. So it's a way of using organic molecules in solar cells, they have advantages, and they actually absorb light more strongly than silicon, which is our current technology, and they can also be much cheaper to produce. Unfortunately, they are not as efficient.
But reading about, if I can interject here, reading about solar cells and the like, nowadays the sort of holy grail seems to be, well, not the holy grail, but one of the best materials is this lead salts with alkyl ammoniums. What's the big deal there? Was this a surprise? seemed to me that my friends who work in the area, this was came out of the blue.
Yeah, that's right. It's just within the last decade or so that this has become a big deal. So it's a crystal structure called perovskites, in which we have lead, we have a halide such as iodine, and some small organic molecule like methyl ammonium. And surprisingly, this sort of hybrid structure is actually can make some extremely efficient solar cells. So there have been rapid progress. We're up to about 20% solar cells that you can make with perovskites now.
20%, that's the efficiency with which the energy coming in is translated into electricity.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's basically the same as the solar panels that you would see on roofs that are made from silicon. Perovskites are also cheaper. The main problem, though, is that they can degrade rapidly. So the state of the art after a lot of progress on stability is that they may last for months operating.
Whereas I didn't know that.
If you buy a normal silicon solar cell to put on your roof, you expect that you can have it working properly for 20 years.
I hope so. I just did it 5 years ago.
Right.
I
mean, that's... Right. And that's if you have some loan or contract with the power company or something. These are the kind of time period that you do the math to see whether this is financially a good decision or not. And if it's only months, then obviously that's not so useful. So we're actually trying to improve the stability.
Very quickly, why is the silicon so much more expensive? Because silicon is everywhere. I mean, I work with silicon materials. It's cheap. So why is this lead complicated molecule less expensive? I don't quite get that.
All right, so it's all about how you actually produce the material. So for silicon, you need actually kind of fanatical purity to make the solar cell work well.
Because it used to be you need big crystals, and then you go to microcrystalline, and that made it a lot easier, I would imagine.
Yes, that's true, yeah. But still you need to do some extremely expensive refining steps to remove all of the dopants. You need these semiconductor fabrications that cost $1 billion.
Well, it's all very interesting. I mean, there's all sorts of different cells. You're doing theoretical calculations. Do you have one specific goal at the moment?
I mean, our overarching goal is trying to figure out how we can use computation to understand materials better, what they're made of and how they work.
That's... And you're making progress.
Yes.
And the funding agencies like you. Basically, that's a good beginning.
Yep, that's right.
David Struve from the University of California, Merced, thank you very much. Thank you for listening out there. Bye-bye.